It's The Wonky Show. We talk bailouts, again, student complaints, international students, and mental health. It's all coming up.
Often you feel very much that, like, you come into the role and you get involved in the day-to-day of the university, and it feels across the sector from all the different officers I've spoken to with this crisis, a lot of officers have just stepped into their element of crisis management almost and really listening closely to students so they can relay on the ground what's going on and what students are thinking and feeling. And we found that that's been really valuable, as you've said, to senior management when they're making...
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, recording from my house in lockdown London. And while the weather may have turned grim, you can always curl up by the fire of informed policy discussion. And to stoke the cold with me this week, we have two fantastic guests. In Bristol, we have Hilary Jebi Ababio, Vice President, Higher Education-elect of the National Union of Students. Hilary, tell us something that cheered you up this week.
What's really cheered me up this week is that my whole flat house have decided that baking is what they want to do constantly. So I've been having a lot of lemon cake and baked goods in general. So it's been great.
And in Exeter, we have Steve Smith, of course, the Vice Chancellor of the University of Exeter. Steve, some good news from your end this week, please.
Well, from my end, one of our postgraduate researchers, Ming Tao Fu, has donated 3,000 items of PPE to hospice care. She sourced it from China and had it sent over. And it's just a wonderful example of how people are coming together in the middle of this crisis.
So we start this week with the joint bailout proposal from Universities UK and Million Plus, which is highlighting how universities can support public sector workers better and puts a bit more meat on the bones of the sector's bailout proposal. Steve, you've been involved in the bailout discussions, I think, since day one. Can you talk us through this?
Yes, certainly. I mean, you've got to understand that it's an incredible achievement that UUK and Alistair Jarvis in particular deserves a lot of credit for this. UUK has been able to get all parts of the sector to agree on an overall bailout package. It's trying to do two big things. Firstly, it's trying to replace lost international fee income, which, as you know, is around the 6.9 billion at risk, because clearly a large number of institutions rely on that income to cross-subsidise research. And at the other side of things, it's trying to look at stopping too much turmoil and too much volatility in the admissions round. If international students don't come, the temptation will be for institutions to take large numbers of home students, thereby introducing a lot of volatility and putting pressure on students to change programs right in the middle of clearing. So for that reason, the bailout project is to try and get a balance between research on the one hand and making sure there's not too much turbulence for institutions that would be financially threatened, I guess, if large numbers of their students went elsewhere. And we're waiting to see the government's response. We're told it's imminent, and we hope that it's favourable.
Hilary, is there something else that you'd like to see in the sector's bailout proposal? I know that NUS has put forward some ideas over the last week. Is there anything that you would like to see that universities specifically lobbying more for, particularly when it comes to kind of the package for students?
Yeah, so I think there's a few things on my mind when I think about the bailout. I'm really, really acutely conscious of students that have recently graduated and students that are graduating now and the job market they're entering, which is going to be extremely, extremely difficult to navigate. So I'm hoping to see some assurances in investment in that area. I'm also very conscious of international students and whether or not we're going to adjust to making sure that whatever the situation, they can still benefit from the UK higher education system and institutions are being flexible and fair about how they're doing that. And then the last thing that I would really be keen to see is an investment in greater accessibility measures. I spoke about a while ago how now that universities are having to put all of these measures in with online teaching and give provision out that is accessible to students that is non-physical, right now, the sector cannot go back from that. So I'm very keen to be seeing investment in that area to make sure that students that need accessibility measures for their education are provided for permanently from now on.
Steve, how do you think these ideas are going down in Whitehall?
I think different government departments are looking at them differently. I think for the Department for Education, they solve a very major problem because, as you know, the turmoil that could be introduced to the admissions round could force a large number of institutions into some quite difficult financial situations. There's some institutions that are financially not very strong at the moment, and it's clearly not good in the middle of this crisis to have them pushed towards to the wall. So the Department for Education, I think, is very keen, certainly on the stabilisation mechanism that we've proposed. They also want a transformation fund, which will allow them to support institutions to move to different kind of provision. I think the blockage, as has been well reported, is really in the financing of this at the Treasury level. It's not, I don't think, so much they don't want to support the university sector, but they, as you know, as well as anyone, Mark, they want to make sure that they can see where the money's being used. So we are in a lot of discussions across the board with different government departments, but this deal requires the Home Office, BEIS, Department for Education, Treasury, Number 10, and others to sign up to it. We're waiting to hear, and we think it's going to be okay. We think there's going to be an announcement. Whether or not it's exactly in time is the issue, because you'll remember the moratorium on unconditional offers ends at the end of this week, and the minister doesn't want to re-announce yet another delay in unconditionals. So there's some urgency in getting the deal sorted out.
I mean, you mentioned unconditionals. What else do you think might be as coming the kind of quid pro quo? Because I mean, you know, there's never going to be kind of free money or policy levers without strings.
Yeah, and I think we're all waiting to see what the strings are going to be. I mean, in a way, the deal itself imposes significant strings. On the one hand, it's saying to institutions that could readily expand, they could replace international student numbers with very, very large numbers of highly qualified UK students. They could do that, and therefore not to do that is actually restraint on their part. I think there'll be something about making sure that the students are absolutely protected through this round. I imagine if I was in Department for Education, I'd be really worried about the pressure that might be put by a turbulent admissions round, with the pressure on students who were trying to work out what they should do. Should they go where they said they were going to go? Should they go somewhere else? So I think there'll be some measures to kind of calm the process down this year, which will be discussed with UCAS and other bodies. But the aim has got to be to come up with an integrated package that works for both bits of the sector. And again, those of us who've been in the sector for a long while know this is a very rare show of unity amongst the sector, because it's very difficult to get the sector to agree on all of these things. So the package is a package. The nightmare, Mark, is if one bit of the package gets accepted but another bit doesn't.
Can you help me out on the market stuff? Because, I mean, all the analysis that I've seen on the face of it, of the student numbers cap proposal out of UK, would allow universities that can recruit large amounts of undergraduates that you hinted at to do so, which means that those institutions that have struggled to recruit in the past or just generally have a smaller market share could find themselves even further squeezed by the big and famous names.
Well, there was a lot of discussion went on about what numbers people had put in. I mean, the as you know, the measure says you can recruit 5% more than you said you were going to recruit this year. Those estimates of what you're going to recruit tend to be quite close to last year's actuals. Therefore, the 5% was a compromise. It was a compromise between some institutions that wanted no increase over last year and other institutions that wanted to take a lot more students than they took last year. So there, it's a political compromise. It allows some flexibility. You've also got to remember, of course, that this year, because A-levels are going to be assessed in a slightly different way, there is the worry that we will have more students achieving their grades than in a normal year, and therefore you might have the awkward legal situation where you get the grades to come to an institution, but because of a cap on last year's numbers, that student can't come, and you're then into a legal dispute with the student. So it was a political compromise, and although you're absolutely right, it will bake in a way the turbulence of recent years, and it does increase it a little bit compared to what it would be, what's termed the Wild West solution. It's much preferable.
And unconditionals being kind of obviously part of the quid pro quo, Hillary, I mean, I go back and forth about this issue a lot, and I'm really keen to know what you think about them. Because on the one end of the spectrum of the argument, people say, well, there's pressure selling, it's not fair on students, which I do have some sympathy with. And I think at kind of the worst end of it, does look a bit like that. But on the other end, it seems to me that with A-level exams cancelled, the data that universities are working on now in terms of the of individual applicants, the data is actually kind of better The data about their success and their achievements is actually better now than it will be potentially in August. So it seems to me kind of it would be more rational to make an offer based on make an offer now rather than later on. But I can sort of see that I can see the arguments both ways. I'm just really keen on what you think.
Yeah, I'm acutely aware of the effects that conditional and unconditional offers can have on students. I think it's really important that we find ways of giving more confident assurances to students that have historically been disadvantaged, like BAME students, for example, in A-level grades, especially predicted grades, and give ourselves time to really look at whether these whether the way we're assessing students and giving them their grades would be correctly mitigated against. So if they are given out offers, the offers are fair and considerate to all of that going on.
Steve, obviously the moratorium's in place, but what was Exeter's policy about unconditionals even going before COVID?
We didn't use unconditionals at all. And we don't use them. So I think the complication comes, as I said earlier, if the deal breaks down, if there's no money forthcoming on the research side, then I think we're going to have to look very carefully at what we do. And we've looked at a number of options. Do we actually go ahead and try and secure the students that have said they want to come to us? We've got 17,500 students under offer to come to Exeter at the moment. We're going to have to think about that, which is why I think the deal, you know, it's a clever deal. It does give something to all parts of the sector. If it breaks down, then I think that is a difficult situation. And I'm certain that for the Secretary of State, the one outcome he doesn't want is a kind of anarchic situation this summer, which frankly isn't going to be, as Hillary says, it's not going to be good for students and it's not going to be good for the sector in the middle of a major crisis.
Yeah, just to add on to that, I think a crucial thought piece that all institutions should be looking at, and I would hope that on a government level they're thinking about, is that however they go forward with this deal, the students that you are accepting in and the students that you are either given offers to or not given offers to, how are you thinking about how they're going to be supported going forward from that? So what is clearing going to look like and how are they going to be supported through that? And the students that do get the offers, how are they going to be supported once they join those institutions in a very acute way? So not just the general package of support that institutions are used to giving, how are you going to support students that may not have had the teaching, the content or the environment to be able to transition into higher education like they normally would.
It's interesting, Hillary, that one of the things that this crisis has taught us is we have to provide very different resources for students from different backgrounds who don't, you know, it's one thing being at home in a middle class household with a good Wi-Fi, good broadband, lots of books, you know, and another being in a very different situation. So we've got, for example, and I'm sure lots of universities have got, we're now loaning out laptops, we're loaning out equipment, we're sending out dongles so people can get internet connection, because teaching remotely and assessing remotely sounds straightforward, but it doesn't half show up the differences in the resources available to students from different backgrounds. And that's going to be an issue, I think, in the coming academic year.
I agree completely. I think it's important that right now we don't stick too tightly to what's been tried and tested, because the nature of this situation means that students are going to need things from you that they might not have necessarily needed as explicitly before. And it's really important that we be innovative but considerate. It's encouraging to see institutions that are really going the extra mile to make sure that's done well.
And in all of that, the absolutely key relationship for us has been with the two student unions we've got at Exeter, the Students Guild on the Exeter campuses and the Students Union down on our Falmouth campus. I mean, we're working with them incredibly closely, and they've been central in helping us identify the needs of various groups of students. And it's a great example of how really, really good cooperation, whatever differences we have over other issues, really good cooperation between students unions and university senior management can actually get the resources to people who need them. And I'm sure around the country there's been really a burgeoning of good working practices between universities and students unions, because they ultimately share the same goals on those issues.
It's been interesting as an officer navigating this pandemic, just because it often you feel very much that like you come into the role and you get involved in the day-to-day of the university, and it feels across the sector from all the different officers I've spoken to with this crisis, a lot of officers have just stepped into their element of crisis management almost, and really listening closely to students so they can relay on the ground what's going on and what students are thinking and feeling. And we found that that's been really valuable, as you said, to senior management when they're making their decisions. And if we continue to have that human aspect where we're really on the ground listening and, you know, moving away from trying to do it in a metrics based way, but we really connect to people as people, I think that's really going to be what gets us through this and what really enables us to support students like they want us to.
It's interesting, just to finish on this point for me, I thought before the crisis, or as the crisis unfolded, I think we tended to think that the resourcing we needed to provide to students was the same. And I think what it's really, really shown me graphically is that when you move to online, actually it accentuates differences between in the resourcing levels of students, you know, the social capital, the physical facilities they have to work in. And, you know, in a way you think online is the same for everyone, but it absolutely isn't. And that's where we need our students' unions to be able to talk to us. Because frankly, we've learned an enormous lot through this process, and we haven't got everything right.
I think there's going to be a big job of doing lessons learned after this, after we've moved on from the worst of this this crisis. And I think it's going to be a massive job when we start to look at what we really mean by looking at disadvantaged students. What does WP actually mean and who falls into it, and how do we support the different groups within that heading appropriately and in not a catch-all type way, but really be targeted so we can give them that close support that they need.
Listening to the dialogue between the two of you is fascinating, and I think I think you know, we've got the incoming NUS Vice President of Higher Education, we've got the senior Vice Chancellor, senior sector figure, and you know, you're both agreeing down the line, and you also both agree about the merits of working together. And I think that something positive that could come out of this is, as Steve, you said, a better, even closer working relationship between student unions and universities, possibly even on the national level as well, between you know, NUS and the rest of the sector. So I'm really enjoying this dialogue, because I think that points us to a different and possibly a really positive place for everyone.
Yeah, and I agree. I agree with Hillary. I mean, because the point is, we're required to think differently, because we've never, none of us, not Hillary, not me, not the NUS, not Exeter University, been in this situation before. And actually, the thing that I've always known about student unions is whatever issues we have about anything, ultimately, they're there to try and support their student members. And in this situation, I'm sure this has happened to you, Hillary, our presidents are coming to us saying, we've been asked to do this by our students. They're getting more engagement because students have real needs. They go to their guild or their union, and the guild or the union comes to us. Before, it was kind of just offered. I suspect that it's been a real learning process for student unions and managements, university managements across the country.
What I'm feeling a lot at the moment is that the way student unions work is really going to be highlighted through this process. I think university management, from my experience, have really seen the value of what we do at students unions past what would traditionally be seen as what an SU or a guild would do, which would be campaigning, or often, you know, it's reported that we do lots of like big flashy stuff when we go on marches and we do demonstrations. But the day-to-day work is what's really impactful, because that's where students are emailing us and coming to speak to us and giving us phone calls, telling us about their own experiences. And that work really influences what we bring to the university. And I think now that's becoming more exposed. And so I really think student unions are going to have a useful but a really big job in restructuring how their relationship with universities look, and how they can be that critical friend in a way that students can know that the pipeline from engaging with your student union representatives and the issues getting brought up to university management flows in a really transparent and coherent way.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, this is Claire Marchant, Chief Exec at UCAS. My piece in Wonky this week has focused on the COVID cohort. So those students and applicants that are looking to come into UK higher education in 2020, and what is driving them and what they feel at the moment. We do know that 75% of them have been personally affected by coronavirus, and certainly that's important for us to remember across the sector as we start thinking not just how we support them in admitting them into UK higher education, but transitioning in the autumn or later during the course of 2020. We also know that the majority of them are sticking with their university choices, but a third of them are thinking about changes. And that makes it really important that we think about how confirmation and clearing this year balances the normal with the different, and how we are more flexible and more encouraging than ever before. We know that social media platforms are more and more important for those students to get the right information and advice, and I focused on that as it's worked really well in recent weeks.
So the Office for the Independent Adjudicator has released its annual report about the official complaints they dealt with over the past year. Hilary, what jumped out at you looking at it?
So the report had a lot of very interesting highlights. It was interesting to see that the overall complaints were up by 21%, bringing it to the highest ever figures that the OIA has gotten. What I found really interesting as well was that a lot of the nature of the complaints were academic appeals based. So it spanned from fitness to practice to sexual harassment and misconduct, and there was quite a bit of focus on consumer rights. I think it would be really interesting seeing how the sector interprets this given the COVID crisis. And I also think that the data that came out with fitness to practice and looking at sexual harassment and misconduct, the two things that I found that really overlapped with that is that a lot of students felt that it was the lack of information and the lack of communication that was really stunting them in those two areas. And I think universities and institutions have a big lesson to learn in making sure that they're transparent and clear when they're going through these processes. The last thing that really stood out that I mentioned just before was consumer rights. And I think right now, and we're seeing that value for money matters now more than ever, especially in assessing what the impact of COVID is going to be on students, alongside the industrial action that many students will have faced this year or as they saw in 2019 too.
Steve, do you think that, I mean, Hilary mentioned the industrial action, which obviously loomed so large over the last year. Do you think the response to that does kind of give us a template for how we deal with the COVID crisis, or is this kind of completely unique?
I mean, I think the OIA report, as every year, shows a number of things, but in a sense, what we're seeing is nothing new. It's a continuation of trends. The strike action has brought to the fore a very, very, very serious issue, which is the extent to which students see themselves as consumers and are treated as consumers. And if they're treated as consumers, you would expect them to react as consumers. So in that way, I think we're all on a learning curve. We spend an enormous amount of time here, and I'm sure every university does, on trying to make sure that whether there's strike action or not, neither the people on strike nor we as the university management want students to be damaged in any way. So there's a lot of work goes on by my colleagues here after strikes are over to mitigate the effects so that their students don't lose. But clearly we are moving and have been moving into a much more marketized higher education system. And what the OIA does and what universities are dealing with a lot more are these kind of complaints. They've grown enormously during my 18 years as a vice chancellor. When I started, students didn't see themselves as consumers, as, quote, paying, quote, for their education. And I think that's altered everything. So this crisis, I think, is we're going to be judged as universities by how well we support our student communities. And I think every university around the country is trying hard to make sure that students don't lose out because of this really rather unique situation.
Mm. And I mean, the OIA itself said that this morning that it's going to need a joined up approach by the sector when it comes to dealing with the COVID crisis, particularly if you know, we're starting to talk about you know, institutions coming close to collapse or some kind of market exit. I mean, they said they're especially worried about disorderly exits, as you might imagine. I mean, that's going to be a worry for everyone. Hilary, what would you like to see the sector do to help protect students and I guess give students confidence that if we are heading towards those kind of things, you know, it's, you know, they're going to be looked after. I think the complaints regime is obviously an important part of this, but it's kind of too late in some ways, you know, if a provider collapses, it's going to be too late to then, you know, kind of remedy that with a complaint if you fall through the cracks.
Yeah, I think the sector has a really tough situation to navigate. I think what students are really needing are a few things. I think right now what's really big is the financial security, and it's not a surprise that tuition fees came up in this report as it usually would do. I think students want to know that they have that financial security, that what they've essentially put in, they're going to get back, so they will get that teaching and the value in their degrees that they signed up for. So I really think that students want assurances that they will still get the degree that they signed up for and still be able to, you know, have something to go out into the job sector or if they want to go into further academia, have somebody to leave their higher education experience with that would be of value to them. I think it's also important that students are really calling for just close support and transparency. I think right now the sector, there's a lot of things going on in the background and students want clarity on what's going on and what their future would look like. Given that everything is so precarious and we don't know what's happening day by day, I think students just want to feel in the loop in what's going on. And I think the NUS Safety Net campaign reflects a lot of that from the feedback that they got in their survey.
Let's see who else has been blogging for us this week.
Hi there, I'm Julie Sanders, Deputy Vice-Chancellor at Newcastle University. My piece was aiming to reflect on the upcoming academic year, really trying to use learning from my own discipline, which is literature and drama, to invite us not just to respond to the COVID-19 context and challenge with talk of remote or online delivery as somehow the new normal, but rather to embrace it as a temporary, a hybrid state, and to invite us all to think creatively and with compassion and with empathy about how to rebuild as quickly as possible next year, accepting certainly imperfection, but hoping that with some passion and heart, we can do things in the best interests of our wonderful students. So for me, it was about valuing the importance of physical encounter and exploration and community, really, and about sowing a few seeds of hope and opportunity amid all the challenges.
Right, QS has released a survey of prospective international students, and it's found, probably unsurprisingly, that many are changing their plans in light of the pandemic crisis. Steve, does that back up what you're seeing at Exeter?
Well, no, it doesn't, and nor does it. I mean, I chair UUK International, and talking yesterday to Vivian Stern, I mean, we see a lot of confirmation of places, a lot of deposits being paid on all these measures. The indications contradict the absolutely clear findings from QS and other sources. Another one coming out soon, I believe, saying very much the same thing. So there's a bit of a nervousness, I guess, about what the real situation is. I think a lot's going to depend on the progress of being able to find a vaccine or how the crisis, is there a second wave here in the autumn? So what we've picked up is that students very much want to continue to come to the UK. They prefer face-to-face learning to remote learning. But the big issue for universities is that I think we don't quite know what the autumn is going to bring in terms of numbers, but clearly the indications from QS survey and others is that there's a lot of concern about from prospective students over whether or not they are going to come and study in the UK. And that, of course, goes back to the big issue of the effect of that loss on the financial sustainability of the university sector in the UK.
And it seems to me that there's a lot of this is outside out of the hands of universities, in that, you know, if there are travel restrictions, simply, you know, if it's impossible for international students to come here, then they won't.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, literally, we do not know, do we, whether you'll be able to travel from the major countries that send international students to the UK. You don't know whether they'll be able to arrive here, and will they have to be quarantined? What will the airfares be? Will there be flights? So there's so much up in the air, and I think that's. I mean, I think the big point to make, though, is my clear view is that the long-term trend is that students will want to travel still to around the world, to leading institutions, that education is still an incredibly important goal of many families around the world. So I think for me, Mark, the question is, this is a one-year problem? Is it a two-year problem? And my view is actually that the education sector in the UK remains one of the great strengths of the UK economy and society. And I expect things to pick up, you know, quickly after that. The difficulty is, bluntly, we don't know how far down we're going to go before we come back up.
Yeah. One of the things that always worth paying attention to is kind of the signals that different governments send, and the small little different things that that can be done that can really affect how people view a country and whether they want to go and study it. And I have a theory that the early part of the UK government's response to the pandemic got a very bad reputation, not just in the UK, but around the world. Nowhere close to as bad as visibly bad as the Trump administration's response. But I hypothesise that a lot of international students will kind of put their sort of health and safety at the top of list of concerns when it comes to deciding what to do. And I wonder whether we've kind of shot ourselves in the foot.
Well, on the other hand, I mean, I agree with you. The signals matter enormously. The government's policy previously to this administration's policy on visas, as you know, was extraordinarily damaging to the sector. The one thing I would say is I think British universities have looked after international students well. I mean, here we've had extraordinary measures working to make sure our international students feel safe and secure. We've sent messages to them. We've provided food for them. We've given them free accommodation. I think, you know, kindness and the message I'd like the sector to focus on is come to the UK. We will look after you. You know, we will not throw you out on the streets. I mean, we will not charge you large sums of money and not allow you to move around. So I think there's a lot we can do. And I think for the UK, the kind of duty of care and the kind of pastoral side of how we look after our students is going to be a big plus, because I think our universities do provide a very good experience to students.
Yeah, I think what would be really interesting in looking at whether international students will find incentive to come back to the UK higher education system is what is going to be looked at in terms of their value for money for what they pay into institutions. A lot of international students I found have come this year to talk about how the tuition fees that they've paid has not matched up to the experience that they expected. And given that we've had strikes and now the pandemic have a big impact on their learning experience, it'll be really interesting to see what the sector does to make sure that they feel confident that A, they're not being used as cash cows, and B, they're getting the support that they need to really thrive coming to the UK education system. And so it'll be really interesting to see how the sector, you know, picks up on that and responds to that.
Yeah, I think my own view, Hilary, is that the sector is acutely aware. I mean, yeah, it concentrates the mind to think of losing £6.9 billion. And that's not to make the simple point about the money, but it I think we talked about it earlier. I think one of the effects of the crisis has been to focus on the stated and actual needs of students. And I think that's a good thing. And I think for international students, I think we've learned very, very, very quickly that some very simple housekeeping things about are they safe? Do they have food? Are they looked after? Can they communicate? Do they have the facilities? Can they have the access? You know, we've got 500 students still on campus here, and they get a phone call every week from someone to make sure they're okay. These things have focused us on how we treat students. And in a way, it's, I think, a helpful corrective to the kind of business as usual. Oh, you know, they'll come, they'll study, they'll get degrees, they'll get good jobs when they go back. And I think it's reminded us that we really, really do have to look after students and not assume they all have the same levels of needs or the same levels of problems and difficulties.
I think now as we start to move towards a new normal, whatever that would look like, it'll be interesting to see what students are feeling about how universities have responded to all of this. And I would be really interested to see if value for money, in the sense that I've heard it from international students, will come up to institutions and the sector and how they would respond to that. Because I appreciate that the sector has done a lot to stretch itself to make sure that international students are supported, especially if they've stayed in the UK. But I think international students are still looking for greater assurances that they're going to be valued more given, like, going forward, sorry. Yeah. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens. But I know that, you know, there's things that are still, like, heavily on their minds to do with visas and to do with even the post-study work visa. There's a lot of international students that are unsure about how that comes into effect. If, for example, it's their graduation year and they've had to move back home because of the crisis, then they're not sure on that.
The fact that the post-study work visa was extended, I think we should push for it to be extended further. I think actually there's a lot we've got to do. You're absolutely right. What happens if you graduate? Then do you come back? How does that work? I have to say, I think the visa regime is, the people dealing with visas in government have been actually very flexible and tried to be genuinely attentive to those needs. But there's a lot we've got to do. There's no God-given right why the UK should be able to take in international students in the numbers we have. I mean, there's a lot of competition out there. We've got to make certain that we provide the very best education and increasingly, Hilary, the support that students need. I mean, that's the key word. And I think that what the crisis has done has meant that a student isn't just a student. Students come in different shapes and sizes and needs and packages, and we've got to be attentive to the very, very different needs that different groups of students have.
David Kernahan, Wonky's Associate Editor, caught up with Wendy Thompson, Vice-Chancellor of the University of London.
Hello, Wendy. Thanks for taking the opportunity to chat to Wonky. Obviously, the University of London is an institution with a distinct mission and a distinct history that will be adapting to the COVID-19 pandemic and the global lockdown in a very different way to lots of other UK providers.
It is a big change for all of us, and that's also the case for the University of London. I guess the difference we have is that we started doing distance education in 1858. So we haven't had to do it on a weekend, as I understand from some of my colleagues, has been necessary. So that's been an advantage for us. Nevertheless, we've had the challenge, if I start with our online education and distance learning, we have one difference. We don't have much coursework on our programs. They're all exam-based assessments. So we haven't been able to use coursework the way others have for finalizing a grade. So that's meant we've had to look at some way of getting our what's about 37,000 students doing some form of assessment that will be different. Add to that we've got 23 time zones. And you can never underestimate the resourcefulness of students when it comes to collaboration, let's call it politely, across time boundaries. We've had to think of some way of getting a secure, credible form of assessment across those time zones. And in many cases, we've got a lot of law degree students and others of that kind. They've got to meet the sort of professional standards of integrity for the qualification. So, that's been our big challenge. Add to it that a lot of the countries we're operating in, their infrastructure is, far from secure in terms of internet and even electricity, really, in some cases. And although, we may complain about working in small apartments in London, you're looking at multi-generational households where students are working alongside, parents, grandparents, children, and perhaps also some domestic animals. So, that was the big challenge for us. And I think really, we have probably gone beyond what anyone else has ever thought about doing. We haven't quite pulled it off, but we've got it planned. It will happen over the next couple of months. It's a combination of, varying the exams a little bit from location to location, encouraging people to use different forms of assessment, more, open book or online kind of essays. And I guess also something called proctoring, which was a new term to me. I hadn't learned before, which is a kind of an online invigilation, if you want to call it that, which adds another dimension of security. Anyway, I've just, told it to you in a minute and a half, and it sounds probably pretty straightforward, but I think it's required some of the, deepest creativities amongst people who've been at this for a while to come up with a way of doing it. While our students, of course, have been running their own campaigns, as you can imagine, advocating for what they'd like to see us doing. So that's been a pretty
good challenge. I was actually going to ask about that, because in lots of the other UK providers, there's been calls for no detriment. There's been calls for assessment based on work before the pandemic started, rather than afterwards. I was kind of naively thinking that for distance learning students, there would be perhaps less of that. But I mean, you're suggesting that's not the case.
No, I mean, most of our work is actually exam based. And that's partly, to keep the credibility and integrity of the qualifications that really, I think, has served our students and the University of London, reputation well. So there's very little coursework in most of our programs. And a lot of our courses, particularly undergraduate programs, are not exclusively online. They're combined with an array of over 100 teaching centers around the world, which I think has allowed our students to, get better outcomes, if you like, by combining the distance with the face-to-face support. Also still delivering, the academic quality and reputation that comes on the on the achievements of our member institutions, so King's, UCL, LSE, Queen Mary, City, these are the institutions that are branded on these qualifications and with whom we've been working. So it's quite an undertaking.
Finally, student mental health remains a top issue for the sector to tackle at the moment in this crisis. And there's been lots of work and thinking going on into how to do that. Hilary, can you talk us through some of that?
So over the past few weeks, we've heard that the OFS have given greater clarity to what student premiums can be used for and disabled student premiums in ensuring that mental health supports and support services are bolstered during this time. We've also seen NUS launched their big campaign, the Student Safety Net campaign, talking a lot about how mental health remains a key issue and giving recommendations on how the sector can support students with mental health support services. And finally, there was a blog uploaded by Student Minds talking all about addressing mental health. And what was really interesting in there is that they talked a lot about listening and making sure that they're listening to students and responding to students based on what they're hearing. So it was really interesting to see that mental health is being taken as a key priority, and it'll be interesting to see how we navigate that with students being at home and in different spaces at the moment.
Steve, how are you thinking about this problem at locally?
Mental health issues have shot up the agenda. I think probably the biggest shock of the last decade has been the rise of mental health issues. I mean, what I mean by that is not the rise as such, but the ability of students to talk about the problem. I mean, I think there's a good side to that, that students can now, there's less stigma than there used to be about admitting to having mental health needs. I mean, we worry about physical health, but we've never really looked at mental health. But in the last 10 years, it's really come along as a major issue. The scary thing for us is, whatever we do, we feel we need to do more. If you have a very bad issue with a student and with a mental health crisis, whatever you've done, you never feel you've done enough. I think the way we're now moving through remote working is going to make that really difficult. I think we are very worried. As you know, at Exeter, we kind of pioneered the safety net policy of no detriment, and that's been adopted by a lot of institutions. But we are worried, and we actually think that we've got a lot of work to do to try and make sure that students do not suffer because of the way in which the form of working we're undertaking puts them under even greater stress. And that, by the way, that applies to staff as well. I think for all of us, these are difficult times in dealing with mental health challenges. But as a vice chancellor, I have to say, it's probably the one thing that has kept me awake at night more than anything else over the last few years, because of the extent to which people are arriving. I mean, we had 2,600 students accessed mental health facilities at the University of Exeter last year, and 25% of those came with pre-existing diagnoses. And that's something which is very different to what, you know, I had when I started out being a VC. So it's massively significant.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via iTunes or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Hillary, Steve and everyone at Team Wonky for making it happen behind the scenes. And until next week, stay safe.